How much of a factor in the Civil War was the prospect that if slaves were freed, they might gain the right to vote?
I think that actually during the period of the Civil War itself, concerns about enfranchisement were relatively small.
And why would that be?
I think that was because as late as 1860, very few people, North or South, actually thought that African Americans were, quotes, worthy of the franchise. We have to remember that not only in the South, I mean, with their slavery, it seems unimaginable to slave owners that that slaves would vote, but that by the time of the Civil War, African Americans had been disfranchised in the North every place but in New England. There had been a number of other states where African Americans could vote in 1800, 1820, such as Pennsylvania, where they could vote until the 1830s, or New York, I think, until the early 1820s. But by the time...
And then disenfranchised.
And they were then disenfranchised. Yes, the progress is not a linear movement forward. It's lots of ups and downs. And the new states that came into the Union between 1790 and 1860, as a rule, did not permit African Americans to vote. They limited the franchise to whites. So that this notion that African Americans ought not be political citizens was extremely widespread at the beginning of the Civil War.
Therefore, the liberation of the slaves was not regarded as something that was likely to lead to the enfranchisement of blacks?
That's absolutely correct. So the freedom.
So this wasn't even on the radar screen.
The freedom of of African Americans, the freedmen, the end of slavery, was. That notion that the freedmen would be enfranchised was a fringe idea held by the most extreme elements. And perhaps this is to get ahead of the story, but one of the most startling transformations in political rhetoric and belief in American history, as far as I'm concerned, is between 1864, 1865, near the end of the Civil War and at the end, and 4 years later, is a transformation in belief about African-American voting, so that it went from being a notion that was really still very much on the fringes to becoming something that could, in effect, be embodied in the 15th Amendment to the Constitution.
After the Civil War, Congress debated different versions of the 15th Amendment, which ultimately did guarantee African-Americans the right to vote. The final text of the amendment had a much narrower scope than what had been considered. Can you walk us through that?
Certainly. When members of Congress were debating a constitutional amendment, we're talking about what kind of constitutional amendment they should have in order to protect the voting rights of African Americans, two impulses appeared, creating pressure towards having what was thought of as a broader amendment, an amendment that would not only ban discrimination based on race, but also perhaps based on class and wealth, on education, on literacy, and then even in some quarters on gender. That there would be a whole lot of different criteria that were in place in 19th century America, some place or other. And that it was believed that that you could pass a broader amendment that would ban discrimination based on any of those grounds. Now, that came really from a couple of different impulses. One, again, was conviction. As people were thinking through these issues, they were saying, well, if you can't deny someone the right to vote based on race, why should you be able to deny them the right to vote based on a pecuniary requirement of some sort, or even based on literacy? So people are thinking this through and trying to be consistent and trying to be principled about it. At the same time, there were also some key political figures, including Henry Wilson, Senator from Massachusetts, from Natick, Massachusetts, who believed in this matter as a matter of principle. But there were a number of politicians who also felt that if the 15th Amendment was narrow and just said you can't discriminate based on race or previous condition of servitude, that African Americans in the South would be subject in the future to being disenfranchised on other grounds, that white Southerners would figure out means to deny them the franchise based on other grounds, such as literacy or such as poverty. And in fact, they were precisely right in that prediction. But that view, the preference for a broader amendment, did not obtain. The political history of this is actually a little mysterious. It remains a little bit mysterious because there were two different versions of the amendment that went into a conference committee in Congress, and what came out of the conference committee was the narrowest of all possible options.
So what's your reading on how that sausage got made?
My reading is that there were some people from some states who adamantly did not want to have other prohibitions built into it. There were the nature of the decentralization of the franchise, the fact that each state could choose, could design its own franchise laws. It also meant that each state could decide who to discriminate against. you had decentralized, autonomous discrimination. So, for example, the Western states, anybody born in China could not vote, could not have any chance of voting. In Rhode Island, foreign-born residents, even if they became citizens, had to meet a property requirement.
That others did not.
And there are requirements like this dotted all around, which meant that a very broad 15th Amendment was going to rankle some people, and was going to be perceived to be against their interest.
So voter suppression has a long heritage in America.
Yes, there's a long history of legal discriminations in voting. It goes back to the founding of the Republic. Actually, the term vote suppression first starts appearing in the 1870s. It's not voter suppression as it's used then, it's vote suppression. But the term actually does start being used. Although I think, as I've tried to think about this and tried to think about the continuities in history, I think that we might want to distinguish between disenfranchisement, which is legally barring somebody from voting, and voter suppression, which is actually preventing someone from voting who is legally entitled to vote. And one way, I think, to think about voter suppression and vote suppression is that's what you do if you want to disfranchise somebody, but you don't have the political strength to be able to disfranchise them outright.
What role did the Supreme Court play during the more than half century when the right of Black Americans and of immigrant populations, their rights to vote, were being substantially curbed in the Jim Crow South and also in the northern regions?
The Supreme Court, for most of this period and most of the time, chose not to protect the voting rights of American citizens, whether immigrants or blacks.
Even though there were two recent amendments that clearly protected
the
those
Supreme
rights.
Court chose to interpret the 15th Amendment in such a way that, in their eyes, a state law or a state policy violated the 15th Amendment, which says you cannot discriminate based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude, that a law would have to, on its face, sort of use one of those discriminatory values, so that you could not pass a law saying, in South Carolina, you could not pass a law saying Negroes can't vote. But you could pass a law saying that you had to meet a literacy requirement or a poll tax requirement, which everybody knew was going to have a hugely disproportionate impact on African Americans. But it was not. But race was not the stated criteria, and the Supreme Court sanctioned that, and thereby
invited more of it.
It does make one exception where it does not accept the legitimacy of a grandfather clause. I think in a case involving Oklahoma in 1915, grandfather clauses were clauses that said, they did not say you could vote only if your grandfather could vote. They said everybody has to meet some kind of requirement, such as a literacy requirement or a poll tax requirement. But you don't have to meet this requirement if your grandfather voted.
Who was allowed to vote only during periods when white voters were enfranchised.
Exactly. Although these laws also existed in the North, so that it was,
is that where the term getting grandfathered in comes
yes,
from?
Yes, it is.
I never realized that.
That is precisely where it comes from. The most flagrant cases, I think, involving the Supreme Court are a little bit later, and there's a series of them, when in the South, many states turned to what would seem to be a more efficient way of keeping blacks out of the electorate, which is to create the white primary or the white-only primary within the Democratic Party. By the time you get to 1905, 1910, there is no Republican Party in the South. It's a one-party region,
It took LBJ to change that.
Right, exactly. It's a one-party region, and the only elections that mattered were the primaries in the Democratic Party. And then various states started passing laws saying only whites could vote in the Democratic Party primaries. And then they would argue in the courts that this did not violate the 15th Amendment, because we were talking about primaries and not general elections. And the Supreme Court accepted that argument in several court cases, abandoning it finally only during World War II.
Well, since that was transparently racist, a white-only primary on its face can't be construed otherwise, was the Supreme Court simply racist?
The Supreme Court, I think, was tacitly accepting the racist structures of political life in the United States. It was embracing the status quo. It was accepting the status quo. I wouldn't want to say that it was racist, but I think that it is accepting that, it is not wanting to counter it. These things in legal and in political terms, and I think we still see aspects of this in today's political life today, Federalist arguments become a legitimate and reasonable sounding set of reasons to accept practices which to other eyes or other ears might appear racist, so that the view is not the white primary is racist, but it's fine. It's that, well, the state of Texas has the right to set up its elections and its political life as it wishes, and it's not up to us in the national government to intervene.
And of course, this is a long-standing contest in American history between states' rights and the ability of the federal government to impose its will.
Absolutely.
To hear more episodes of Humankind, you can subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast player. A new episode each week. The podcast title is Humankind on Public Radio. And if you enjoy this program, be sure to leave us a kind review at iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to support the program, please visit humanmedia.org. And at the top of the homepage, click on How You Can Help. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org. Thanks.